and welcome to Pod Catalyst. I'm Peter Finn, Executive Director at IABC, and today I get a chance to talk with Selma Shelbaya. Selma is the Chief Marketing and Communications Officer at Yardstick Management, where she oversees the internal and external communications, strategy alignment, marketing, public relations, branding, and communication project management solutions for clients. She's also an adjunct professor of business, media, and communications for Clayton State University. Selma has more than 17 years of experience as a journalist and communication and public relations expert. This includes a seven-year tenure at CNN, where in 2015, she was awarded the CNN Diversity Ovation Award for her commitment to inclusion in news coverage. Selma is passionate about diversity, human uniqueness, unraveling taboo traditions, and is dedicated to promoting the voices of underrepresented individuals. And I got a chance to talk with Selma about her career and current experiences as an executive at Yardstick Management, as well as just getting her perspective on social media. I read an article or interview rather with Selma a few months ago in reference to Elon Musk's pending purchase of Twitter, and really wanted to get a chance to get her on the podcast. So I'm so glad she was able to join us, and I think you'll really enjoy the interview. So Selma, thanks so much for speaking with me today. I think a lot of our members and listeners will be interested in what you have to say. But just to get started, if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into the role that you're in today and a little bit about your background.
Sure. So a little bit about my personal background. I think it's critical for the work that I do today. I am an Egyptian American immigrant. Came here at 10 years old and always knew that I wanted to be a journalist. And got the fortunate situation to be in the space where I worked at CNN. I spent most of my career working at CNN in different capacities. I started on the international desk, spent about 7 years there covering a lot of different things, international news, but then moved into .com, did some work in writing niche pieces that were focused on specifically the Arab diaspora and the Muslim diaspora, and more particularly Muslim women. And having been raised as a Muslim woman, it was just a great opportunity to be able to represent that voice and that space, but also did a lot of social media coverage. I maintained our Twitter account actually for News Source, CNN Digital News Source, which is our distribution powerhouse. We had affiliates of over thousands of affiliates all over the world, but more than 900 at the time in the US. And so we maintained that rapport and that interaction on Twitter, and I was able to do that. I was a producer, a writer, you know, different phases throughout the course of my years at CNN. But simultaneously, I always had a passion for education, higher education. And so I've always taught at the university level. I taught at, started at Georgia State University, taught Arabic there. And then I moved from Georgia State into Brunel University, taught a lot of their master's programs of business communication, intercultural communication, public speaking, creative writing and thinking, et cetera. And then from there, I went to Clayton State University. I still teach there as an adjunct. So for me, it was always about communications in general. And while I was at CNN, and you know this from just being in the industry, it's a lifestyle, right? You live, eat, breathe, sleep, you know, everything that you do is news. And especially, you know, when I was dealing with international news and breaking news constantly on the fly. So I knew at some point that I would probably move into the communication space. And the more I taught, the more I built the interest there. But also I was approached to do a lot of communication consulting. And so through that time of being asked to come in and train, et cetera, I decided to open up my business in 2015 while I was still at CNN. And it was just the side, you know, communication firm on the side. And what really got me was when the Carter Center asked me to do a training in Switzerland with the world leaders. It was a media training. And at that point, I was like, okay, I think it's time for me to make the switch and move into communications. It was a good opportunity to break into that space. It's similar, but it's not the same, like being a journalist, et cetera. So left CNN 2018, focused on the business for a bit, worked with a diverse amount of clientele, corporate, personal, politicians, et cetera. Then I got recruited for SCAD and did PR. And so my viewpoint was always like at a high level, well, PR is part of what I do in my own business. So this is kind of like a big client. So let me go in and get the experience, expertise, et cetera. did that for about a year and didn't like the politics, but loved the space and the creativity. And then left again. I said, let me focus on my business. Let me focus on my book. Let me do that. Got recruited again in the current role that I'm in with Yardstick Management. Yardstick Management is the nation's leading Black-owned management consulting firm. And we focus on management consulting, but really with the core of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And that was critical to me because I've always cared about that space. And so it felt like the right thing at the right time. And to be able to go in and build that brand, I started 2 years ago. I just marked my 2-year anniversary. And it's an honor to have built it to become the nation's leading and, you know, being recognized by Inc. magazine. Literally this month, we just got recognized as best in business.
And oh, wow. Today, congratulations.
Thank you so much. Yeah. It's the second year in a row. So we're very excited about that. But last year we were best in business in HR, this year in management consulting. And it's really an honor. They wrote a full feature about the work we do and the impact we make. And it's been great. And today we're about to announce actually Georgia Best in Business. So it's pretty cool stuff. So
yeah, that's awesome.
I love it. I mean, it's definitely deserved. I work with really, really awesome people who care about marginalized communities, and we do, you know, transformative work. So not sure if I'm giving you too much or too little, but that's really my journey of
how
I got to where I am today.
How long has Yardstick been around? Is it a fairly new company or?
Well, you know, funny thing is we've been around for 10 years, but we really have seen our most growth, particularly in the past 2 years. To give you an idea, so when I started 2020, we were an $800,000 company, and we are now $8 million company. So in the past 2 years with George Floyd and all just the madness across the nation, racial tension, we've been asked by a lot of big companies like Amazon, Netflix, Facebook, big, huge companies to come in and look at their processes and their internal DI practices and promotions, representation, et cetera. We also do executive search. So that's a big part. All of our executive search placements are Black and brown talent. And, you know, the common stereotype is that talent doesn't exist in the marginalized communities. And so we say, no, it does. You just have to go to the right places to find it. So we've seen a tremendous growth in our employee base, in our revenue, in our client base by almost 400% across the board.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
That's a great story. Well, so one of the reasons why I want to interview is, well, one, because you have a fascinating background, but also, you know, I read an interview with you, I think it was in May. So it was right around when, you know, there was Elon Musk was going to, or was about to, or take over Twitter by Twitter. So, you know, it was in Business Insider. So I found the interview fascinating. And also just when we think about the impact of the Musk purchase of Twitter and, you know, on the communications profession. So you had shared some thoughts about how, you know, he could use this to his advantage. And I was curious, you know, has his leadership style lived up to your predictions? I mean, back in May, you know, from May when you were discussing this, I mean, what's your impression now of how things have kind of played out?
Oh, well, you know, it's funny, when I did that interview with Business Insider, I was like, do I really want to put myself out there like that, right? Because now I'm going to become like the Elon Musk expert, right? And I'm not. But I will say, when I did that interview, I recall stating that his style was casual and strategic, and that he'd have to really be careful with balancing those two things out and not coming across as too casual and being intentional, right? Intentional about the audience, intentional about his delivery, and in a way that really feeds his bottom line. At the end of the day, he is a businessman. And of course, as all businessmen, they're going to look, or business people are going to look at, you know, the interests and finances of their organization. And so I would say that his style, like, certainly lived up to my earlier predictions, the casual approach of communication that he's had, whether it be talking to employees or making statements with the media or posting on Twitter, has come across too casual, I would argue. And for some, maybe even, you know, offensive. There's been a lot of criticism of his casualty. And we've seen the past couple of weeks, some of the lawsuits and, you know, accusations of how casual it was. And and how demanding it might have been with the employees to ask them to specifically work hardcore, quote unquote, or not be there, right? So that's that's an ultimatum, right? Extremely hardcore or leave the company. And so I would say, yeah, it's lived up to what I had anticipated. It's one thing to be casual and resonate with the audience because people want that. They don't want too many formalities. It's another thing to be too casual and not maintain a level of respect and dignity, because at the end of the day, you're dealing with humans and people who deserve that. And so he's got a tough line to walk throughout as he's making these changes with Twitter.
Has anything surprised you about, you know, how things have played out?
I would say the massive layoffs, specifically like with certain departments, right?
Yeah.
Especially the communications department, as we're talking about communication now. And he's always been a fan of like the freedom of speech, right? And having that space of everyone gets to talk, everyone gets to say what they want, how much they want, but not necessarily the reach, right? That's what he's trying to work on. Freedom of speech, but not freedom of reach, right? Like he wants to almost have a control over that. But I think that, again, that strategic approach, how do you balance the two and how do you, you know, ensure that you've got the right people, the right resources, the right expertise in-house to handle that, and letting go of a communications department without having a backup or someone who's going to come in and improve those areas of the organization can be problematic, can be concerning, because as we've seen, due to that, there were no responses to certain inquiries about those layoffs and about what's going on in Twitter. And sometimes, you know, taking matters in your own hands may not be the best approach, may not necessarily resonate with a larger audience for clarity and understanding. So what surprised me is probably the his approach on the layoffs. And not necessarily, I mean, organizations go through layoffs in general. I mean, we're seeing it across the board. I mean, we are going through an economic, you know, adversity, and we're going to see more of that, especially in the tech space. So I'm not surprised by layoffs per se. I'm surprised by the approach of it and the way that he's almost conducted his communications delivery with the people. And, you know, people want him to treat them with respect. And so, especially during times of layoffs, we want to do our due diligence. We want to take our time. We want to be sensitive to people's needs. And when it comes to doing layoffs in December, which typically a lot of layoffs unfortunately take place right before the holidays. And so it's a very difficult time for individuals. And being mindful of that, I think, will warrant him respect in return.
So SpaceX and Tesla, because there's no comms department for those companies either, right? So that was a trend that kind of played out with Twitter. Is that right?
Yes, which speaks to prioritization, right? Like what is priority for him and bottom line for him, right? And I can't speak on his behalf, but you know, we see for ourselves. And so if that's the trend in the organizations that he leads, it more than likely means that that's not a priority for him. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, communications is everything. Obviously you're speaking to someone who's in the space, but I would argue in, you know, soft skills in general are what gets us through any work environment and any place, and especially as a leader.
Yeah.
When you're a leader, you know, your job is to serve others, not necessarily tell them what to do or how to do it, but you're serving them. You're learning their styles. You're learning their needs in order to feed into the bottom line and the ROIs of that organization. And so, especially when you're the world's, you know, richest and you've got all the power and the autonomy and the impact, you know, people are looking up to you to see how you do that, what you do with that. And so it's, you know, then at the end of the day, we can't tell Elon or anyone what to do or how to do it, but there will be criticism of the approach because you are on the front line of information and in front of people, and you're highlighting yourself, and you become someone who's got that level of power, you're going to be open to scrutiny from individuals who are watching you.
And do you see anyone else trying to adopt Musk's approach, you know, in terms of, you know, his comms approach?
I don't know if I see anyone. I mean, I have worked with a lot of companies that may not necessarily feel like communication is top priority. I will say that we're always advocating for that. We've seen, like, especially with like the racial tension across the nation, we've seen organizations scramble trying to figure out what to do and how to respond to issues. And now they become more reactive than proactive because they never really prioritized communication. And I think you don't realize it until crises hits, right? And now you're dealing with crisis communication. But really, if you have something that's consistent in place and a strategy and a roadmap and a way to handle the business effectively and efficiently, communicating that externally, then you don't really have to react. And it's a battle, it's a struggle trying to get companies to make that a goal, to ensure that they've got their communications in place. It keeps me in business, but because then they come to me. But I wouldn't be, I don't know what others are doing. I do know that a lot of even huge organizations do not have a very strong communications department or person or leader in place.
So, and I also just want to get your perspective on just, you know, social media in general, like, you know, it's, so we talked about Twitter, but just other channels and, you know, what's your perspective on kind of the state of social media and, you know, the role of the communicator within an organization?
Obviously, social media has expanded tremendously and grown in terms of platforms and access in the past decade, right? But more, mostly like in the past 5 years, I would say we're just seeing all sorts of media. I have children and, you know, they're teens. And so I get to see all the new, you know, social media. There's now something called Reel, or I think it's called Reel. And, you know, outside of TikTok and, you know, a Twitter and Facebook is now, like, you know, old school for the young generation, et cetera. So I don't see that changing. We're going to get a multitude of platforms and a lot more people have access to it globally because, you know, the small village syndrome that we're in, everybody's, the whole world is just a small village. I would say it's changing in the sense of that the more people that have access and input and ability to share information, the more information we have to weed through, especially as communicators and journalists in particular, you know, who have the responsibility of reporting, you know, facts and accuracy, complete information and with accuracy, et cetera. So I think the challenge is, how do you weed through all of that? We already are doing it in every other component, right? When we're reporting in the field as journalists, or when we're communicating with our organization internally or externally as part of that brand. But when you get to social media, now everybody can say anything at any moment, as much as they want, or as little as they want, and blast it wherever they want. That, to me, that puts a responsibility on the communicator who's looking through it and distributing. And so I think the challenge is, how do you maintain the integrity, the reporting integrity, as you report out? And it puts a lot of responsibility on communicators. And unless they're willing to step up to that responsibility, it's going to be very messy.
Are there, you know, new platforms, channels that, you know, communicators should kind of keep the pulse on? Or, you know, I mean, I know TikTok, there's just been a lot of companies that have tried to adopt it and use it as a communication channel. And I mean, what's your thoughts on that, or any advice for folks?
My take is, it depends. Like, you know, at the end of the day, you have to think of what's relevant to what you're doing and what's newsworthy and what's timely, right? We go back to the journalism, like, foundations, right? I think TikTok is not for everyone, right? Or maybe it is, right? Like, you have to think of, I'll give you an example. We've worked with Orange Theory, right? That was one of our clients, and they have a very active social media account, but they went through a difficult time with George Floyd, where, you know, they didn't respond or they didn't say anything, they were silent. A lot of organizations went through this. They're not the only ones. But there came a point where they were confused about, well, what do we post and how much do we post and where do we post, right? Do we need to create other channels to post this? And then you've got different audiences who are demanding different things, right? Like the Gen Zs versus the millennials versus, you know, the older generations, and they're all wanting multiple channels. So as an organization, I think your most important initial step is to figure out, who are your audiences? You know, where are they? And how, what do I need to do to reach them? And that's what will help you decide on which platforms make the most sense. I think as communicators and as leaders in that space, you have to think that way. When I joined Yardstick, we didn't have a communications anything. As a matter of fact, I remember you know, Ebbe Parsons, our founder, he said, I just want you to join. I don't know what I want you to do. Maybe you could help me figure out what to do. And I said, you need communications. And so we started from the strategy. Who are your audiences? Who are you trying to reach? Where are you currently posting? Does that make sense to you? Are you making the most of your resources and your time and your energy, et cetera? So your question to like, are there other platforms? I would say there's plenty of platforms everywhere, but at the end of the day, they have to be the right platforms for the right organization based on the audiences they're trying to reach. I don't recommend TikTok for everybody unless you've got some storytelling components that make sense for the company. And also, if you don't have the right resources to maintain those social media platforms, then you're really shooting yourself in the foot, in my opinion. You're really not going to be consistent, and it's going to be problematic because you're going to be radio silent. And now you've got a platform and your name is out there, and that could mess up your brand more than anything.
Yeah. Yeah. I was sort of curious too, like, you know, you talk about the murder of George Floyd and, you know, but also just we live in a very polarized political environment. I know you're in Georgia. So just curious, like, you know, just advice for companies that, you know, as we kind of will go into what will likely be a very heated presidential election. But I mean, are there things that you advise clients on as, you know, you're trying to, you know, where, you know, as you're talking about Orange Theory, but, you know, where to kind of draw the line on things and, you know, or where to hold back? I mean, it's, I know probably a lot of that goes to the values and of the organization and, you know, their kind of vision as a company, but I don't know if you had any thoughts on that, because I'm sure it comes up in your work.
Oh yeah, all the time. Part of what we do is actually part of what my team does with regards to client consultations, because, you know, we do the marketing and comms for Yardstick, but also for the clients as needed. And we saw a huge rise in the demand for that because they don't know how to respond to certain issues. So one of the things that we try to tell our clients to focus on is their employees, their people. Their people matter more than anything. The more you're in tune with your people and their needs and their wants and what they're going through, you know, not ignoring social justice issues that are taking place in the nation and not dismissing, you know, any crises that are happening, you know, in the news. Or we've seen last year, there was like the shootings in the Asian American community. And so like responding and being, you know, proactive about that, sharing tools and resources with the employees to help them get through that if they are indeed sharing an identity with that organization that's being impacted. So I think companies have, especially leaders within those companies, they have a duty and a responsibility to understand their people and to make sure that their people are, one, being represented at the leadership level. So if I am Egyptian, you know, Turkish American, right, a Muslim woman, if I don't see anybody in the leadership space that has some level of representation that I identify with, that's going to be very challenging for me to open up and share and be vulnerable and bring all of me as it relates to the work and my concerns, et cetera. Or if I'm a Black woman and there is no representation in the C-suite or in the leadership space, it's very hard, again, to have that diversity of thought as decisions are being made. And so I would say the number one thing that I advise companies is ensuring that there's representation. You can't represent everyone, clearly. We understand that. But you have to seek that and make it a company goal to have representation across the board, across functions, across levels. That makes sense for your employee base and your contributors. And then two is being ahead of the news. Like just being mindful that the world doesn't stop as soon as employees clock in and they're working for you. The world is still happening. There are things going on. We're witnessing some serious changes in the economy that's impacting families, impacting your employees directly. Post-pandemic, and we're still living, you know, in the pandemic, right? A lot of lifestyles have changed. Some of these employees are now living in multi-generation households, taking care of their families, or single mothers. I'm a single mom, you know, taking care of their children and managing their jobs. So companies need to be in tune with the humanness of their employees and figure out ways to tailor to them as well and make them feel like this is a place of belonging. They don't have to put themselves outside of the workspace once they clock in. I would also say responding to crises immediately and letting employees know that you're thinking about them. I mean, we hear we do a lot of qualitative interviews as we're assessing with our clients. And we hear so much from employees the moment that they feel like they're being recognized for what's happening outside of the workplace. They just feel like, you know, their employers get it, or they send them resources. Maybe it's wellness resources or places where they could contribute and feel like they have a community. So we highly encourage companies to do that representation and then being ahead of any sort of crises that are taking place in the community and in tune with their employees, just really checking in.
That's great. And I guess the other thing I wanted to ask you about too, just hearing about your background and the kind of work that you do today, just how your, you know, when you were a journalist, you know, how that has, you know, with CNN and how that kind of built a foundation for the role that you have today as a, as an executive in the C-suite. I'm just curious about that. You know, what are some of those tools that, you know, have served you very well in the position that you have?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, it was actually a really, really good question when I was sitting here trying to figure out what I'm going to say. because I, you know, you're moving so fast in life. And I think my journey has always been a very fast pace in general, just the way I grew up and the expectations and being an immigrant and, you know, running the home, raising my brother, like all that stuff. But so you're always moving so fast, you never really have a moment to sit down and think through what that process looked like and how you got where you are. I will say, CNN in particular and my time spent there has exposed me to so much of what has become of me today. I had a lot of personal growth there, but also professional growth. I would say the people I worked with were really like some of the best individuals, human beings that I have ever met. And the level of integrity of like getting to the source. I think your question earlier too talked about that. Like, you know, what should communicators do? Get to the source. Who said what and why, when, where, you know, how, get to the bottom line. One of the things that I learned from there more than anything is that speed is not everything. And it's kind of counteractive to what we do in journalism, right? But it's speed and accuracy. Like they both matter. They go hand in hand. And I remember many times, as you know, like CNN and Fox, you know, they're the rivals, and Fox would shoot out something immediately quickly and we'd all be like, ah, they're first again, blah, blah, blah. And I remember our leaders would always say, you know what, that's fine, let them be first, but we need to be first to be right. So let's just take our time and be first and right. So I always tell my employees, I want you to focus on speed plus accuracy. They both matter equally. Don't move too fast and then push out content that's incorrect. And now other people will utilize that content. And now we've created a mass, you know, false situation of inaccuracies everywhere. I would say being at CNN also helped me obviously focus on people in a weird kind of way, right? We're seeing a lot of trauma, you know, daily. I've covered a lot of trauma with breaking news, a lot of devastation and heartbreak. And especially when you're doing stories and you're interviewing individuals who are going through that situation, just being sensitive to that. And as a leader now, like recognizing the human first before the work that comes with it within my employees, I think it's so important to be sensitive to that. When I'm asking them a question or when I'm, you know, tasking them with some item, like, am I aware of what their capacities are? What's on their plate? What's going on, et cetera. And I'm not saying we need to be counselors per se, right? Or therapists, but we need to be human, right? So part of that is you have to treat people with respect and say that they matter above anything else that you do. And I think CNN helped me do that, like for sure, maybe indirectly, but the work that I did as a journalist helped me focus on people. And then I would also say the multitasking, you know, that's a big one. The more I have grown in my career, the more I realize that it's not just about multitasking, but it's about multitasking with the bottom line in mind and the big picture. So you've got all these priorities, like which of these are you going to tackle and figure out first together, combined to get to your end goal? And so that takes a lot of focus on efficiency and making sure that I'm constantly reprioritizing what's important based on the time and the relevance and all of the things that I mentioned earlier. And then, you know, I would say remembering the purpose of why we're doing what we're doing. Like, yeah. I always try to talk to a lot of my colleagues about this and a lot of my team members. before you make a decision, think about why you're making that decision. Before you decide on pushing out a social media post and a press release and a newsletter, why? As a matter of fact, I tell that to my own boss too, because he loves what we do and he's so excited about it. And he's got an amazing, fun personality. So he's ready to push out and share everything. As a matter of fact, he shares a ton of stuff on his social. And I'm like, let's slow down. Let's be strategic. Why are you pushing this out now? And we haven't even announced it. So let's slow down, announce first, and then strategically we could all. So he's always coming to me. He'll say, you know, can I push this out just on my own personal account? And I'm like, okay, but don't say that. We're not ready. It's embargoed, you know? So just thinking about less is more, time is everything. And just, you know, being intentional and strategic is really critical as we're pushing out any content.
Yeah. Well, and your comment about empathy is interesting because I was thinking about that, you know, just with the last couple of years with the pandemic. I feel like people have really, especially leaders, have really had to build that muscle to really empathize with the employees, and just heard a lot about that. And I think, you know, for the most part, it's probably made companies better, organizations better, because there's that kind of connection. So I guess perhaps something of silver lining over the last couple of years.
True. Yeah. I mean, was it, I think it was Forbes pushed out an article last year about the most important trait in a leader is empathy. Mm-hmm. And it's something that stretches leaders, because everybody's like so focused on bottom line of business interest, but really people are your bottom line. I mean, if you don't have the people to do the work that you need done, and we've seen that with the pandemic, because a lot of people just basically quit. They didn't want to deal with that anymore. They realized that, wait a minute, I'm not really living life. I'm not doing all the other things I need to do. And I need a space and place that allows me to live my life completely. And I need safety in the workspace, and et cetera. So as a matter of fact, this is related to empathy and leadership. We kicked off an institute, a leadership and vulnerability institute, actually, in this past year.
In vulnerability?
Yeah, it's called.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And it's focused on leaders, specifically the executive suite, from across the board. I mean, we've had the president of Coke, the CEO of Logitech, Indeed. I mean, like top companies be present in this room, in this space, and just coming in with a very vulnerable approach about what they're encountering, what they're going through, and how they can do it differently collectively with DEI in mind and bring it back into the workspace for their employees, their struggles, their issues, et cetera. But as leaders don't really have a space to be that vulnerable, right? And so we thought, let's create that. And it's quite diverse. I mean, representation from across the board. And it's been amazing, like really, really amazing to witness them come there and share out and be open. And none of them, I mean, I didn't see many of them on their phones doing anything. They were really engaged, because you don't really get an opportunity to speak about the realness of situations in your companies as it relates to the people. So our next one is coming up too, with that one. And we do it in really cool places. So we did one in St. Simons Island. I don't know if you know the history of St. Simons, Georgia, but do you know the history?
No, not really.
So St. Simons, to give you perspective, it's really close to Brunswick, where Ahmaud Arbery was shot. Okay. There is, I don't know if you know much about why that was such a big deal, where it was located, where he was shot, but St. Simons Island, to give you more perspective, used to be 99% Black. Mm-hmm. And now it is 99% white and like less than 1% Black population. The reason why it used to be that much of a Black population is because that's where most of the slaves were transferred to and from. And that's where a mass suicide of Black people took place. The largest suicide, mass suicide of Black people, population slaves, took place. And so it's got a lot of history of enslavement and tension, racial tension, et cetera. As a matter of fact, if you go there and visit today, they still have the homes and the plantations where slaves used to live. And so it's a very interesting place. And our founder wanted to change the situation and the outlook and the representation in that community. And so he wanted to create more representation. He bought a home there. He brought the institute there. We've been hosting it, and we've had it there twice. We're doing it for the third time again in January. And then we did one in Nevis in the Caribbean, which is also got some history with regards to the Black community. So, you know, lots of work to be done. And got to go back to the roots to figure out what we can do differently.
Well, I just think it's really interesting, like, to have a connection with the space, this place in the world. Sometimes people are just like, oh, we'll find a nice hotel and have our meeting. You know, it's like there's a real connection there and kind of the purpose of the meeting and what you're trying to do. That's really, really, really cool. Yeah.
I mean, it takes me back to that. I feel like the intentionality, it precedes everything else as a leader. Like, you've got to be intentional. You got to think of others more than you're thinking of yourself. And then once you think of them, then you figure out how to conduct yourself.
So one last question for you. What gets you up in the morning? This is what we ask everybody.
Another great question. Some
people say their alarm, but
that's a struggle. I don't wait. My alarm does not get me up as easily as I wish it would. Two things. My daughter's number one, probably. I have a 16 and a 12-year-old daughter, and they are young ladies. And as a woman who, again, comes from an underrepresented community, probably don't get to hear much of a voice of an Arab Muslim woman. I really think it's so important that they see a role model and a representation for them. My kids are even furthermore, they've got a diverse background. So former interracial marriage, their father's Pakistani. So there's a lot going on with their identities. And so I try, it's very hard, it's harder said than done, but I try to get them to recognize the wonderful and the beautiful, like, concepts and values that they have and they can bring to the table and to the world from their diverse background. And so I try to do that. Like, I have to practice what I tell them. And so it's being that role model for them, being that woman who's going to grind and hustle and work hard and change my perspective and my views based on my growth. I used to wear hijab. I don't wear it anymore. So having them see that you're allowed to make choices and you can have access and you can change your mind for the better of you is really critical for me. And then I would say the other thing is my purpose. I would say it's not always clear, but I think for me, again, my background is really, really, really important to me. And I hope that whatever I do, it always empowers others to be true to themselves, to be vulnerable, to be open. Because the more we can be open, especially when we're in positions of power and impact, the more we allow others to do the same. And so for me, like, having that voice and helping others find their voice and representation across the board, including the work that I do at Yardstick, right? Ensuring that there is representation at the leadership level gives me that urge to want to wake up in the morning and continue doing the work that I do.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Selma, for taking the time to speak with me. I really, really enjoyed hearing about your background and what you're doing now and just perspective all the way around. So I thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much to Selma for speaking with me. It was really a pleasure and just really interesting perspective. You know, her work as a journalist and her work in DE&I and the work at Yardstick, really, really fascinating and just a lovely person to speak with. So have a wonderful holiday season and thanks so much for listening.